This is Tom reading Bloomberg Business Week from the month of May and Bloomberg.com on May 27th. Stocks fall as U.S. pushes back on Iran draft report. Markets wrap. Wall Street traders halted a rally in stocks as optimism over a resolution of hostilities in the Middle East waned, with the White House pushing back on the existence of a draft deal to revive the Strait of Hormuz. Following a blistering advance to all-time highs, the S&P 500 edged lower. U.S. crude paired its decline, trading around $90. The U.S. denied an Iranian state television report about a draft interim peace agreement that said traffic through the key waterway could return to normal within a month of it coming into effect. Just because Iran state media reported something doesn't mean the deal is done, said Brian Jacobson at Annex Wealth Management. Traders have been on high alert for clues on the status of talks that could lead to a Hormuz reopening. Traffic through the strait has shriveled since the conflict erupted, causing energy prices to soar while rattling economies, companies, and markets. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump said Iran would not get sanctions relief in exchange for giving up their highly enriched uranium, PBS News reported. They're going to give up their highly enriched uranium, not for sanctions relief. No, no, not at all, Trump told PBS. The stock market has enough confidence that a resolution with Iran will eventually come to light, even if it's not immediate, said Alexander Grigliano at Resonant Wealth Partners. While it may seem like stocks have moved too fast, we saw a garden variety correction only 2 months ago, which helped to reset sentiment and paved the way for this most recent rally. Veteran market strategist Ed Yardeni dismissed concerns that U.S. stocks are in a bubble, arguing that recent advance was driven by solid corporate profits rather than speculation. The big difference is earnings, Yardeni told Bloomberg Television's Surveillance. He coined the term FEMO, fabulous earnings momentum, to distinguish the current rally from FOMO, or fear of missing out, which he said is based on hope and hype rather than fundamentals. Earnings growth powered by the AI boom will drive further gains in stocks, Goldman Sachs Group Inc. strategist, led by Ben Snyder, said as they increased their year-end target for the S&P 500 to 8,000 points. The gauge currently trades near 7,500. Continued earnings growth should drive continued equity market upside, they wrote. The increased return forecast reflects increased estimates for S&P 500 earnings following an exceptionally strong first quarter reporting season. Americans are about to pay even more at the grocery store. As Americans confront a surge in prices at the pump, another inflation wave is headed for the grocery store. A combination of factors, including bad weather, tariffs, and a dwindling cattle herd, are already pushing up grocery prices at an above-average pace. In April, they rose by the most in nearly 4 years, and economists say the impact of the Iran war and a potential El Nino weather pattern will only add to pressures into 2027. The hit to U.S. household finances from higher grocery bills is set to intensify just ahead of the November midterm elections, amplifying affordability as a defining issue. And to a greater extent than the surge in gas prices, the slower moving food shock will be difficult to reverse quickly because the size of autumn harvest is determined by planting decisions made in the spring. It's going to be a challenging year, said Ricky Volpe, an agribusiness professor at California Polytech State University, who previously worked at the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Economic Research Service. Food is going to become less affordable, and consumers should be prepared for it. The latest USDA price food price outlook published Friday, projected a 3.2% advance in grocery prices this year. Well, Volpe said he expects inflation more on the order of 4 to 4.5%. James Geis of Madison, Wisconsin said he lives on his own but is making adjustments with rising grocery prices, like cutting back on prepared foods and meat. Geis, 62, is even trying to grow potatoes in his backyard to supplement his food budget. "I'm very concerned," he said. "I'm probably considered middle income, but it's starting to pinch." Outsized price increases so far in 2026 have reflected a mix of bad luck, trade policy, and slower-moving pressures linked to climate change. The weather in particular has not been kind to American farmers, who have endured outbursts of record-breaking heat, historic cold, ping-pong-sized hail, and wildfires. The U.S. saw its warmest ever start to the year, with temperatures running about 6 degrees Fahrenheit, 3 degrees centigrade, above average, through the end of April, according to the National Centers for Environmental Information. The early heat prompted some domestic crops to begin blossoming weeks ahead of schedule instead of remaining dormant throughout the winter, leaving them exposed to subsequent frosts, according to Brad Rippey, a USDA meteorologist. Beef prices, among the most politically sensitive in the U.S., rose to a record in April thanks to the smallest cattle herd in 75 years, squeezed by drought and high production costs. Tomato prices, meanwhile, surged 33% over the last 2 months after two winter storms brought widespread damage during the peak of the growing season in Florida, while shipments from Mexico were declining following the Trump administration's imposition of duties on imports. Heat and drought in the western and central U.S. spell more pressures to come. California accounts for almost half of the annual U.S. vegetable and three-quarters of fruit and nut cash receipts. And diminished snowpack in the Sierra Nevada this year to just 23% of typical levels as of mid-April has raised concerns about irrigation supplies. Drought is also spread across the nation's breadbasket, where staple wheat crops that are typically used to make all-purpose flour or pasta have withered for lack of rain. As of May 19, 70% of U.S. winter wheat production was in areas of drought, along with 25% of corn production, according to the National Drought Mitigation Center at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. And forecasters now say an El Niño weather pattern is likely to emerge by August, with rising odds of an unusually powerful event that will persist into 2027 and push global average temperatures higher. El Niño can often steer extra rain to California, but it's also best known to fuel drought outside the U.S. in major growing areas for rice, coffee, cocoa, and more. Then there's the war, which has brought a massive shock to global fertilizer markets due to the Middle East's role as a major supplier of inputs. Prices of fertilizer are up 20% since the war began, according to the Green Markets Index for North America. That will likely mean higher prices come harvest time, and if farmers decide to scale back applications, that would also leave crops less able to withstand heat, drought, or flooding. The higher cost of fuel itself will also find its way into prices on store shelves as farmers and carriers pay up for diesel to power tractors and trucks, and petroleum-based plastic packaging becomes more expensive. Major grocery chains have been trying to hold the line on pricing. Kroger Company's chief executive officer said it's planning a price-cutting push to compete more fiercely with Walmart, Inc., which has expanded its efforts to keep prices low over the last year. Consumers are already worn out because prices have continued to climb, even though the rate of food inflation has come down, says Andrew Herrig, a vice president with the trade group FMI, the Food Industry Association. At the same time, household debt is rising, the personal savings rate is falling, and real average hourly earnings fell in the 12 months through April for the first time in 3 years. Federal Reserve Bank of New York published data Wednesday indicating a meaningful increase in measures of food insecurity between October 2025 and February 2026. Lots of people, I think, still look at their pre-COVID grocery bill in 2019, early 2020, and say, wow, I'm paying significantly more, Herrick said. And so they're feeling that stretch. Diamond expects $1 billion more in costs as traders get windfalls. J.P. Morgan Chase & Company will probably spend about $1 billion more this year than executives expected just last month, according to Chief Executive Officer Jamie Dimon. The firm's full-year costs will be closer to $106 billion than the $105 billion guidance executives reaffirmed in an April earnings presentation, Dimon said Wednesday at the Bernstein Strategic Decisions Conference. The increase is mostly driven by better performance, so it's a good extra billion, Dimon said, hiding higher-than-expected investment banking fees and increased trading revenue. On Wall Street, executives preach an eat-what-you-kill mentality, offering traders and dealmakers bonuses in line with the revenue they generate. That means a boon in investment banking and markets activity often translates to an increase in compensation expenses as well as other transaction costs. J.P. Morgan shares were down about 2.8% to $298.07 at 11:31 a.m. in New York Wednesday, making it the worst performer in the 24-member KBW Bank Index. The bank's traders, fresh off a record quarter, are on track for their second-best quarter ever. Dimon said markets revenue for the 3 months ending June 30 could rise 11% from a year ago or even more. Investment banking fees, meanwhile, are expected to climb 10% and could be a little better, depending on how the rest of the quarter turns out, he said. It's gung-ho, folks, Dimon said. Sponsors are busy. Companies are busy. There's a lot of exuberance out there. J.P. Morgan is also on the hunt for its next deal. Dimon said the firm is on the outlook for potential acquisitions, but cautioned that it can be patient with capital. I do think there might be, in the next couple of years, a chance to put $10 billion to $20 billion to work buying something, Dimon said. J.P. Morgan and other big banks have seen a rise in competitors doing direct lending in recent years. Dimon said his bank has done about $20 billion of direct loans itself, with about $14 billion still on its books. While it's a faster way to lend, it also tends to come with higher borrowing costs for customers, he added. If there's a turn in the credit cycle, it could create a competitive advantage for healthy banks and private credit funds alike, Dimon said. In downturns, healthy companies have opportunities, Dimon said. If you're a client, we want to offer you the full range of products, and you get to decide. San Francisco rents spiked 22% in a year, far outpacing other U.S. cities. In San Francisco's latest real estate boom, renters are paying cash up front, multi-million-dollar houses are selling auction style, and AI company stock can buy a sprawling hilltop estate. It's a reflection of the new wave of wealth from the artificial intelligence industry, leaving even well-paid newcomers scrambling for a place to live. For Jenny Lee, a Chicago tech worker, seeking to join her boyfriend in the Bay Area, finding an apartment has at times felt more difficult than getting a job. She has spent 6 months searching for a San Francisco rental, flying in for tours, and repeatedly losing out on offers, even after the couple almost doubled their budget to $6,500 a month for a two-bedroom. In Illinois, her friends were living in desirable places for less than half of that. At one point, she showed up to what she thought was a private appointment just to wait in line and later find out someone had already signed a lease. One $7,000 a month home didn't have a washer dryer, though the touring agent assured her that there was a laundromat down the street. Lee recently applied for a place she liked, only to get a text an hour later saying someone else was willing to pay a full year's worth of rent up front in cash. My Chicago brain couldn't compute that, she said. San Francisco's new tech frenzy is reigniting home bidding wars and sending prices soaring in a city that just a few years ago was mired in post-pandemic malaise. With the AI industry paying hefty compensation to attract the talent, and hometown startups OpenAI and Anthropic PBC commanding valuations approaching $1 trillion, the wealth effects are warping the entire residential market. And upcoming initial public offerings from the likes of SpaceX are set to unleash even more money into the market from early investors. The city leads the U.S. in annual rent growth, according to apartment listing firm Zumper. Prices for two bedrooms are now tied with New York for the most expensive in the country, with a median monthly rent of $5,500, the company said in a report this week. The median rent for a one-bedroom crossed $4,000 for the first time ever. Homebuyers are also facing soaring costs. The median price for a San Francisco house recently hit a record $2.15 million. The surge is sharpening divides in a city defined by its extremes. San Francisco has long been mired in deep inequality, a place where a homeless encampment can be on the next block from houses owned by tech millionaires. Now the real estate frenzy is colliding with broader wealth tensions across the state. Californians are facing a potential ballot measure to levy a tax on billionaires, while housing is a central issue in this year's governor's race. And while the real estate market has been accelerating, the labor market tells a different story, suggesting the boom is concentrated among those benefiting from the AI fervor. While overall employment in the Bay Area is recovering from the pandemic, job creation has been modest. The San Francisco, Oakland, Fremont metropolitan area has added roughly 10,000 to 15,000 jobs over the past year, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics data. One of the big mysteries in San Francisco is how can you have such a hot housing market when you have such a cold labor market, said Ted Egan, chief economist for the city and county of San Francisco. If you have some people moving in and nobody moving out and you don't have any new supply, that can create a spike. For sellers, the frenzy is translated into windfalls. When real estate agent Butch Hayes listed a four-bedroom home in the Marina neighborhood in March, he figured it would fetch around $4 million, netting the owner a profit from the $3.4 million they paid 2 years ago. Within days, the house drew five all-cash offers. Instead of choosing one, Hayes turned the process into an impromptu auction, asking buyers to bid against each other in $100,000 increments. The home ultimately sold for $4.9 million. The competition has only intensified. Hayes said a recent listing in the Central Richmond neighborhood drew seven showing requests almost immediately and an offer within an hour. The buyers of the four-bedroom, five-bath house paid $4.95 million, plus covered the broker commission for the sellers, pushing the total value of the sale to more than $1 million over asking. The market has gotten so tight that many buyers are simply dropping out. Hayes said he started the year working with about 20 clients. Now less than five are still actively searching. His response when asked about the available inventory, what inventory? With supply scarce and competition fierce, some sellers are getting creative, betting that the same AI boom driving up real estate prices can also unlock new ways to pay for homes. Storm Duncan, the founder and managing partner at a tech investment bank called Ignatius, is offering his roughly 13-acre estate in Marin County's Mill Valley, north of San Francisco, in exchange for hard-to-get shares of Anthropic. The 4-bed, 5-bath home, featuring an infinity pool, a putting green, and a fruit orchard, is worth around $8 million, said Duncan, who is part of the wave of tech workers who moved to Miami during the pandemic. And although Duncan says he has never heard of anyone who has done such a transaction, he sees this as an opportunity to grow his investment in AI. I was sitting there thinking, how do I get invested here? He said, and then I thought, maybe there's someone else that has the opposite problem I have, which is they're already invested, and they started working there very early, or they coincidentally got some seed shares or early shares as a VC, and now they're worth hundreds of millions of dollars, but it's all illiquid. Duncan said he's already fielded interest from potential buyers, such as a foreign investor looking to diversify out of concentrated tech holdings. Others have asked about replicating the structure with shares in companies like SpaceX, he said. The turnabout in the market has been swift for prospective buyers. With Cedric Bailey and Michael Clary started looking for a home almost a year ago, they thought they had the upper hand. Bailey, a lawyer at a tech firm who has lived in San Francisco for 7 years, already owned a condo in the Mission Dolores area, so the couple wasn't in a rush. They were looking for a bigger home ahead of the birth of their first child, ideally a 3- or 4-bedroom that would also accommodate their German Shepherd and French Bulldog. We felt like we were basically in control, Bailey said. We would go see a property and say, look, we're only going to pay this amount. If they take it, great. If they don't, it's not for us. And that strategy has had to change starting this year. Several bids they made faced about 10 competing offers, Bailey said, including some in all cash. Selling homes they tracked were selling for as much as double the asking price. After losing out several times, the couple eventually secured a home by viewing it before it officially hit the market and putting in an offer 25% over asking that same day. We saw a rapid big boom starting September and October, and it caught everybody off guard, said Frank Nolan, the president of Vanguard Properties. There's a house that somebody bought for around $4 million this fall that is probably worth $5 million right now. The demand is creating ripple effects. Many would-be buyers are turning to the rental market to secure a place while they find their home, driving apartment prices further up, said Rachel Swan, an agent at Coldwell Banker Realty. Swan recently listed a 2-bedroom home in the Four Seasons private residences for $15,000 a month and immediately had multiple people who were interested. She's seen rentals that are 600 square feet with no parking go for $6,500 a month. With the sales market heated, one client who was basically a billionaire preferred to rent. For these people, these payments are nothing. Supreme Court asked to revive GOP-drawn Alabama voting map. Alabama officials asked the U.S. Supreme Court to reinstate a Republican-drawn voting map that would eliminate a majority black congressional district and give the GOP a likely pickup in the November midterms. The emergency request in the long-running legal saga follows a lower court decision Tuesday, rejecting the proposed map for the third time as the product of intentional discrimination against black voters. The clash is part of the fallout from the April 29 Supreme Court ruling that sharply limited the role of the landmark Voting Rights Act in redistricting. The 6-3 decision sparked a push in Republican-controlled southern states to carve up majority black districts that had traditionally voted Democratic. The Alabama dispute is unique because a 3-judge panel had previously ordered the state to keep its current map through the 2030 election. The existing map includes 2 majority black seats, both won by Democrats in 2024. The Supreme Court reopened the fight on May 11, setting aside the lower court decision and telling the three judges to reconsider in light of the recently issued Voting Rights Act decision. But in its ruling Tuesday, the panel said the Supreme Court opinion didn't eliminate the need for a second majority black district. The panel said Alabama lawmakers violated the Constitution in 2023 by intentionally leaving black voters short of a majority in a pivotal district, raising an issue that wasn't before the high court in the Voting Rights Act dispute. We cannot see our way clear to requiring Alabamians to cast their votes in the 2026 elections under a districting plan tainted by intentional race-based discrimination, wrote the panel, which consisted of Democrat-appointed U.S. Circuit Judge Stanley Marcus and Republican-appointed district judges Ann Manasco and Terry Moore. In a filing Wednesday, Alabama Attorney General Steve Marshall said the ruling would force the state to divide voters up based on their race. The state did not intentionally discriminate by declining to intentionally discriminate, Marshall argued. He asked the Supreme Court to issue a decision by Monday. The legal wrangling has left Alabama's elections in a state of upheaval. Although voters selected party nominees in three of the state's seven congressional districts on May 19, Republican Governor Kay Ivey set a special primary election for August 11 for the other four districts, the lines of which now will be determined by the outcome of the Supreme Court clash. Bloomberg Opinion. Blanche is Trump's latest enabler-in-chief. Roy Kahn, the infamous lawyer cum thug, who once represented celebrities, politicians, mobsters, and Donald Trump, has long held a special place in the president's heart. You know how many lawyers in New York represent organized crime figures? Trump noted during an interview in 1997 after I asked him about his relationship with Kahn. Does that mean we're not supposed to use them? The president was willing to overlook Kahn's shortcomings because he provided a valuable service, Trump told me when we revisited the subject in another interview 8 years later. Roy was brutal, but he was a very loyal guy. He brutalized for you. Trump has searched for new brutalizers ever since Kahn's death in 1986, especially when he's landed in a tight corner. After former Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from overseeing a federal investigation into Trump's possible intersections with Russians attempting to sabotage the 2016 presidential election, the president fretted no one knew how to run interference for him. "Where's my Roy Kahn?" he complained, according to the New York Times. So it's tempting to identify a Kahn proxy at each turn of Trump's two White House tours. Everyone from Bill Barr and Michael Cohen to Rudy Giuliani and Stephen Miller have been trotted out over the years as Trump's new consigliere. The comparisons are descriptive, of course, and even useful, but not entirely apt. Kahn was an unusually predatory and corrupt abettor who openly consorted with criminals. However wayward, unlawful, or brutish Trump's Kahn standards have been, they haven't fully measured up to the original. The lesson in all of this, though, isn't that Trump can't find his new Roy Kahn. It's that there's an endless supply of lawyers and others willing to cozy up to him by trying to play the part. And that brings us to Acting Attorney General Todd Blanche. Blanche, too, has attracted his share of Kahn comparisons. The two men couldn't be more outwardly different. Kahn looked and feasted like a grizzled, balding vulture. Blanche presents as an earnest and well-meaning Boy Scout. When Blanche is questioned about his handiwork for the president or various Trumpian financial conflicts of interest, his eyebrows furrow and his eyes widen as he methodically describes Trump's fundamental transparency and honesty. There's nothing unprecedented about the Trump Organization going out and trying to make investments that basically all will come back to the American people and jobs in this country, he told ABC News in February. When asked about the confluence of Trump's newfound crypto riches, national security, and semiconductor deals with the United Arab Emirates. And so this idea that there's something untoward or unprecedented is just a repeated story that isn't true. The truth is that Trump's flagrant monetization of his presidency is entirely untoward and unprecedented. But Blanche, the Justice Department's Deputy Attorney General at the time of the ABC interview, was auditioning for a more muscular role in Trump's ecosystem. After the president concluded that Attorney General Pam Bondi wasn't carrying enough of his water and fired her in April, he appointed Blanche as the new steward of the nation's premier law enforcement agency. The Justice Department and its Attorney General are meant to operate independently of any Democratic or Republican president, simply to ensure that the law is applied fairly. Trump has never seen it that way, however, and has tried using the agency as a retribution juggernaut, with Blanche at the helm. Blanche routinely demurs when asked about the open politicization of the Justice Department, insisting that such critiques are simply false. My colleague Barbara McQuaid, a former federal prosecutor, described last week's establishment of a $1.8 billion taxpayer-funded piggy bank that Trump can dip into to reward purported victims of federal lawfare, including the January 6, 2021 insurrectionists, as a grifter fund. Blanche, who will help oversee this jackpot, dismissed outrage over the fund as ignoring the reality that it is completely legal, allowed under our laws, and has been done before. The creation of the fund also came with a special benefit that Blanche orchestrated for Trump, his business, and his two eldest sons, permanent immunity from federal tax audits. The Trumps may have been facing as much as $100 million in Internal Revenue Service payments associated with an apparently continuing audit of write-offs associated with a Chicago condominium project. That audit will now presumably disappear. One tax specialist described Blanche's get-out-of-audit-free card to Bloomberg News as a breathtaking abuse of the tax and legal system. Blanche would have none of that. The fact that the IRS is settling a case and not moving forward with an audit is not unusual, he told CNN. Despite Blanche's insistence that he's administering the law dispassionately and with respect for legal norms, a federal judge in Tennessee slammed him when he dismissed one of the Justice Department's high-profile criminal cases last Friday. He said Blanche's conduct in the prosecution involving a defendant named Kilmer Armando Abrego Garcia taints the investigation with a vindictive motive. Blanche pursued the case, the judge ruled, to buttress the executive branch's decision to deport Abrego Garcia, an immigrant, to El Salvador. When Abrego Garcia challenged his deportation, the court said Blanche helped engineer a criminal case against him in retaliation. The evidence before this court sadly reflects an abuse of prosecuting power, the judge observed. The Justice Department said it planned to appeal the order and described it as the work of an activist judge who placed politics above public safety. Blanche may not be a perfect replacement for Roy Cohn, and the president may continue to feel deprived. That doesn't really matter, however. What is essential is that the malfeasance and corruption clinging to Trump and his presidency continue because he is surrounded by enablers. Blanche is currently at the top of his class in that regard, and he'll remain in the president's good graces just as long as he follows orders. If Trump grows weary of Blanche, he'll easily find a replacement. For while there may be only one Roy Cohn, the ranks of Trump enablers are legion. From Bloomberg Businessweek, the Bachelor's to Barista Pipeline. The share of recent grads stuck in jobs that don't require a degree is growing. is AI or a soft economy to blame? They thought they did everything right, took on debt, sat through 4 years of lectures and labs, pulled all-nighters to write papers and cram for exams, and finally earned their college degrees. Now they've left working jobs that high schoolers could land, ringing up customers at clothing stores, pulling espresso shots at coffee shops, and nannying to cover their bills. Meet today's growing class of underemployed college graduates, the term economists use to describe young people stuck in a job that doesn't require the degree they earned. They made up almost 43% of U.S. graduates aged 22 to 27 as of December 2025, up more than 3 percentage points for the year and the highest rate since the pandemic, according to the New York Federal Reserve Bank. That's a significant increase over just 12 months, though the rate still tracks below those logged during the Great Recession. It's easy to blame artificial intelligence. After all, there's no shortage of research pointing to how the emerging technology is automating away scores of junior roles in the white-collar industries that many college graduates target. Studies conducted by the Stanford Digital Economy Lab and Harvard University professors found that occupations such as software development, customer service, and marketing have experienced declines in early career employment since the widespread adoption of AI tools. But the bigger culprit for the woes of recent grads is an imbalance in supply and demand that's been quietly building for years. From 2004 to 2024, college completions in the U.S. rose by 54%, according to Lightcast, a labor market analytics company, whereas entry-level jobs suitable for those graduates grew by just 42%. To make matters worse, what students are studying is out of sync with where the economy is creating jobs. The result, in 22 of 35 fields of study, the ratio of entry-level jobs per graduate declined over the past two decades, according to a Bloomberg analysis of Lightcast data. We've never seen so many changes all at the same time and at this speed, says Elena Magrini, the head of global research at Lightcast. This is the first time where the education pathway to jobs is kind of broken. The young are often the first to pay the price with the arrival of labor-saving technology or an economic crisis. Almost half of all recent U.S. university grads were underemployed in 1992, when the country was emerging from a downturn and computers were becoming ubiquitous in the workplace, and again from 2012 to 2015 in the aftermath of the global financial crisis. While the U.S. does not appear to be in a recession right now, the combination of high interest rates, President Trump's ever-changing tariffs, and the rapid improvement in generative AI tools has contributed to a low-hire, low-fire environment. This has all but halted the typical churn that helps new grads get a foot in the door. Entry-level roles made up 74% of the jobs available in the market in 2025. In 2029, when post-financial crisis unemployment peaked, they were 79%, Lightcast shows. In a job market that is tight, employers can find more experienced folks to fill junior jobs, says Sean Van Derzel, president and chief executive of the National Association of College and Employers. And AI has made many take a bit of a pause on hiring. Economists say a higher education system that only recently started to course correct may be the biggest impediment new grads face. For years, the schools didn't tailor curriculums and class sizes to correspond to the skills in demand from employers, and students picked majors that didn't align with the fields creating the most jobs. Take healthcare, a bright spot with nearly 1.9 million entry-level job openings in 2024. College completions for health-related programs grew just 5% from 2014 to 2024, while other fields saw double or even triple-digit increases, according to Lightcast data. On the flip side, perhaps no field has collapsed more dramatically than computer and information sciences. From 2014 to 2024, entry-level openings grew about 6%, while the number of graduates soared by 110%. A host of employers, including Amazon, Atlassian, and Block, have cited AI in recent layoff announcements, but a January report from Forrester highlighted a trend of AI washing, noting that many of the job cuts were actually financially motivated. The recent wave of industry downsizing has left aspiring software engineers in desperate straits. Cody Viscardi, 29, says he sent almost 1,000 applications into the void since graduated from McNeese State University in Louisiana in 2023. While he saw fellow computer science majors in the year above him land cushy six-figure positions at Amazon after college, Viscardi knew his job search would be harder, but not this hard. He's landed only six interviews for positions paying at least $60,000 a year. Viscardi worked minimum wage jobs to make ends meet during his job search. Then a friend told him about an electrician gig that paid $23 an hour, no experience required. Now he works as a union electrician, earning as much as $63 an hour, a job that takes him all around the country. Viscardi, who was, along with his sister, is the first generation of his family to graduate from college, still dreams of working as a software engineer someday. On top of his 50 to 60 hour work weeks, he's been taking online courses offered by the University of Tennessee at Knoxville for a master's in computer science with a concentration in data mining and intelligence systems. Colleges should at least have the capability of getting you a decent job so you're not stuck with $100,000 in debt making minimum wage, Viscardi says. I was hoping not to continue the cycle of being forced to be blue collar. Even though it's still good money, I was wanting more from life rather than just chasing a check. More than 1,000 educational institutions are consulting Lightcast to adjust majors and class sizes to fit the economy's needs. But most aren't, says Jeff Stroll, the director of research at Georgetown University's Center on Education and the Workforce. You could have a perfectly good program, but if you have too many graduates, their outcomes are not going to be good, he says. Bachelor's institutions don't coordinate much at all. That puts the onus on students to respond to the changing reality. At Stanford University, where a large share of the students study engineering and intro to computer science is one of the most popular classes, enrollment in CS courses in the fall and winter quarters of the current academic year was down almost 10% from a year earlier, the first drop in many years, according to Angie Davis, a spokesperson for the university. If it's any consolation for today's young, underemployed workers, the majority of their peers in the aftermath of the Great Recession were able to transition into jobs requiring a degree within 5 years, according to a 2018 paper by a pair of researchers at the New York Fed. It's not unusual for recent college grads to have difficulty finding a college job when they transition into the labor market, says Jason Abel, the head of microeconomics at the New York Fed and one of the paper's authors. However, for many, working in a non-college job is only a temporary phenomenon. Spending thousands to get your kid hired. Business is booming for the career coaches of the very young. The old parental anxiety over getting the kids into college has been followed by a new one, getting the kids a job after graduation. Facing a job market that's downright hostile to fresh grads, parents with means are paying thousands of dollars, in some cases tens of thousands, to pair their college-age children with career coaches years before their careers will begin. Business is brisk for coaches like Beth Handler Grunt, whose New Jersey-based counseling company Next Great Step offers small group programs and private advising to give students the polish they need to land a job. When she started more than a decade ago, Handler Grunt had to sell parents on her value. Now she employs a growing team It fields referrals and works with students as early as freshman year so they can secure those ever more important internships and build resumes to compete in an increasingly cutthroat environment. The services offered by private coaches aren't fundamentally different from those provided at college career centers, notes Christine Kruzvergara, an executive at entry-level job site Handshake, who leads partnerships with colleges and universities. Kruzvergara, who previously led career services at Wellesley College and George Mason University, says many students are unaware of how much their school's career center can help. Plenty of clients for Handler Grunt and other coaches come via college consultants whose former customers are now seeking help with cover letters instead of admission essays. Her six-month program runs from $4,000 to $15,000. I call it part two, says Handler Grunt, who advertises a placement rate of more than 80% for her clients. You make all of this investment with college advisors and set SAT prep to get them in. Our goal is to get them out. Career coaching for college students can cost a few hundred dollars an hour for interview, rehearsals, and application strategies, with more comprehensive packages typically ranging from $3,000 to $10,000. But New York-based Priority Candidates says some parents are paying upwards of $30,000 for intensive support and subject matter experts to prepare their children for entry-level jobs in finance and similarly ultra-competitive industries. The price tags at other companies go up from there. Had it been 5 years ago, I don't think I would have hired anyone like that, says Lori Storch-Smith, a pediatrician in Westport, Connecticut, who hired Next Great Step last year as her daughter was preparing to graduate from the University of Rhode Island with a marketing degree. She really needed to put her best foot forward in this market. It's so hard for these kids right now to get jobs. College students are often more than happy with the help, parents and coaches say. Storch Smith's daughter, Haley Smith, ultimately landed a job in Boston and was particularly grateful for the support in navigating the alienating nature of one-way video interviews. Weekly group sessions, workbooks, and one-on-one coaching helped turn a daunting process into something that felt manageable. Just as valuable, Haley says, was the consistent encouragement and individualized feedback that helped keep her spirits and confidence up. Career coaching for students is a newly lucrative niche for an industry best known for helping mid-career workers uncover their true purpose after years of cubicle toil. In 2019, about 5% of career coaches focused primarily on college students or new grads, according to the International Association of Career Coaches. Its latest surveys show more than a quarter now consider that group a core segment. For parents, coaching can seem like a wise investment given the total annual cost of attendance at a private four-year college, including room and board, is expected to surpass $65,000 as per college board estimates. Plus, some coaches note, it's cheaper than keeping kids on the payroll at home. Doug Rohn, a lawyer in Los Angeles, recently hired a career coach for his 16-year-old son, a high school sophomore. Before the family starts working with an admissions counselor, Rohn wants the coach to help his son think through what major he'll pursue at college. We're not unusual, says Rohn, who spent about $1,500 on the coaching. I think most people do this calculation because college is so expensive. You want to make sure that you're putting your kids at the right school for the right career path to get an ROI on the tuition you're paying. Still, Rohn acknowledges with some chagrin that it can sound like a lot charting a professional plan at such an early age. That's kind of sad, right? You're dealing with a 16-year-old boy. All he wants to do is run around with his friends. For those set on Wall Street careers for their progeny, it helps to have a finance titan's budget. Companies such as Command Education, Priority Candidates, and Weil & Wine say they can help students win investment banking jobs, which can pay more than $180,000 for a first-year analyst. Some of these companies charge anywhere from $30,000 to the high five figures. Services include guidance on getting into selective campus clubs, tutoring for technical interviews, and networking and support. They also help candidates manage the 50-plus applications they're likely to submit, from meticulously tailored cover letters to the high-stakes gauntlet of back-to-back final round interviews. Command Education's founder, Christopher Rim, famous for charging $750,000 to help get kids into Harvard and Yale, offers bespoke career coaching programs tailored by industry that range from a few months to a year, with prices starting at $50,000. Some clients start work with him as early as the summer after high school graduation. That level of strategizing can be too much for kids just learning to do their own laundry, though, and coaches will tell parents when their teens aren't ready yet. Lisa Trettler, founder of New York-based career coaching firm GradVantage, has also had to remind parents that their children are the clients, even if mom and dad are paying. It's a tough little dance, she says, especially when they seek a certain career path for their kids, regardless of what the kids desire for themselves. I want these young people to be open-minded, and I need the parents to be open-minded as well. Dorm room entrepreneurs take off. Starting your own thing can build your resume and maybe get you paid, too. Most college students spend their first semester adjusting to lecture hall classes and navigating life away from home. Now more of them are doing that while also conducting market research, building prototypes, and figuring out how to file a certificate of incorporation in Delaware. Dhruv Sajikumar was still in his first semester at Carnegie Mellon University when he started building an artificial intelligence platform for consulting firms. He took a leave of absence from school in January, and by the end of that month, the 18-year-old and his co-founders had raised about $2 million in pre-seed capital. Honestly, I was expecting to finish my first year, said Sajikumar, who enjoyed campus life and joined a fraternity. But everything happened fast. On some calls, he says, investors committed 10 minutes in. At universities across the U.S., undergraduate entrepreneurship classes, once considered niche, are now packed with long wait lists, and on-campus accelerator programs are at capacity. A suite of startup incubator programs at Johns Hopkins University that attracted 50 applications 5 years ago drew interest from more than 860 hopefuls this school year. AI is one of the major reasons for entrepreneurship's growing appeal. The technology is radically lowering barriers to entry, speeding the process of testing concepts, and building prototypes, creating big opportunities for those who act fast. Another factor is the dismal entry-level job market for new college graduates. Jill Tipograph, a career coach who works with college students and recent graduates, says as internships and jobs get harder to find, more of her college-age clients are turning to entrepreneurial side gigs to build their resumes. Even if their efforts don't pan out, the initiative and resilience it takes students to get even a modest venture off the ground can impress prospective employers and set them apart in a sea of candidates, she says. School is already popular with would-be founders like Stanford University. What's changing isn't so much the interest level as it is the speed and scale of capital flowing to student-run startups, according to Charles Easley, an engineering professor and co-director of the Stanford Technology Ventures Program. Students used to take a decade to find companies. Now they're going from classrooms to $4 million in 3 months, he says. Two of his undergraduates took their AI healthcare software idea, hatched as a class project, to influential startup accelerator Y Combinator. They were live testing their concept in hospitals before they even came of legal drinking age. Venture capitalists, meanwhile, have started to smell the opportunities on college campuses. Many funds are investing earlier, currying favors with undergraduates through campus visits and direct messaging on LinkedIn. Some firms have launched startup accelerators that recruit college students rather than waiting on typical Silicon Valley imprimaturs like a stint at Google. The result is often exceptionally favorable terms for the investors. You want to come in at a valuation that's really low because you're a college student and you don't really know what a valuation means, says Akhil Smith, who founded a software startup while at Carnegie Mellon. They take a lot of equity really early on, like Shekhar Kumar, Smith also opted to take a leave of absence from school rather than drop out. Although quitting school added to the mystiques of famous founders, including Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Michael Dell, and Mark Zuckerberg, it's a drastic step. Taking leave for a semester or two offers sensible hedge against the possibility that the startup doesn't take off. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology is among the schools reevaluating leave policies and developing programs to support students who want to take a semester off. More VC firms are catering to budding entrepreneurs who are set on completing their studies. San Francisco-based IOVC specifically courts people in the process of turning side hustles into full-time work. Fractional founders, it calls them. Last fall, Y Combinator launched a program called Early Decision that allows students to secure a spot in a future cohort. A lot of students are viewing leaves of absence the way that more traditional students might view a study abroad, says Kyle Judah, executive director of the Lou Idea Lab for Innovation and Entrepreneurship at Rice University. Rather than studying, traveling, and partying abroad, we're seeing more Rice student founders take a leave of absence to spend a semester at a hacker house in San Francisco or Boston. Undergraduate enrollment in entrepreneurship courses at Rice more than doubled over the past 3 years, Judah said. The number of teams applying to the university's in-house accelerator has already doubled from the 65 applications submitted last school year. Rice junior Egg Halleck, who started school with plans of becoming a neurosurgeon, says he was ultimately drawn to technology as a way to solve more systematic problems in medicine. He's now working on a startup building autonomous drones capable of organ delivery. When a few of Halleck's pre-med friends weren't able to land the kinds of clinical research gigs they needed to get into medical school, they too started their own side projects, he said. Some saw it as an empowering alternative to a potentially dead-end job search. And then they find that, oh well, this is actually more fun, he adds. Like many students, they're keeping their options open. Carnegie Mellon senior Avalon Suero, who's set to graduate in May, has been applying for jobs while she builds a simulator to help political campaigns figure out what issues to focus on and what messaging will be most effective. The sorts of strategic questions small campaigns typically can't afford to hire consultants for, even if she isn't able to realize her idea post-graduation, she says, at least I have something that I really care about on my resume.